Welcome, everyone, to episode 527 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we are possibly halfway to a Warriors Heat NBA Finals. So we're going to catch up on where both conference finals stand, what the Celtics and the Mavericks can do to get back into their respective series. Game three of Warriors Mavericks is tonight. We're recording this on Sunday afternoon. So before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews, and we're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is Tari Eason's biggest fan, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
Yeah. No, he definitely should give me a cut of that first NBA contract, that's for sure.
Now that we've gotten Chris Middleton paid and Seth Curry paid, now you are the unofficial agent of Tari Eason.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it didn't work out with those first two in terms of us getting a little moolah. So first time's the charm.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's hope. So more, let's jump right in. Let's start in the East. So, because we're recording this on Sunday afternoon, so that everything that we say about the West could be wrong in about 5 hours. So yeah. at least this will apply until tomorrow night. Game three was just like three games packed into one in terms of narratives. The Heat jump out to a 26-point lead early in the game. Celtics come back slightly. I think it was a 15-point halftime lead. Then Jimmy Butler comes out in the second half, is not going to come back for the rest of the game. He has knee inflammation. Marcus Smart goes down early in the third quarter with what looked like, based on his reaction, I thought that was the last we saw Marcus Smart in the series. Like,
oh, this season.
Yeah. I mean, it looked bad. It wasn't even his reaction. Like, his ankle just rolled in a way that ankles are not supposed to move. So it looks
literally
like
was like a 90 degree turn. Yes.
Yeah. Not good. So he goes
and even double that. Like, right. Like, as I remember it, he rolled his ankle, and who was the player on top of the foot? Because it almost like when it was bouncing back, there was a Heat player, you know, pushing back on it once again. It was almost like a double roll.
Yeah. Yeah, regardless, somehow he comes back into the game, like minutes later, and then hits a three immediately and cuts the Miami lead to 10. So, like, that entire third quarter just felt like the Celtics had all the momentum, but, like, they were down 15 at the start of the quarter, and then they were down 15 at the end of the quarter. Like, to the Heat's credit, they just kept holding them at arm's length throughout the quarter. Fourth quarter, you know, again, the Celtics are threatening, cut it to 8 at one point. I think even cut it to 6 at one point late in the game. Jason Tatum goes out with what, again, appears to be a serious shoulder injury. He comes back in like a minute or two later. So just a ton of
Paul Pierce wheelchair moments.
I know. Yeah. Either there were a lot of like toradol shots being handed out in the back or a lot of trips to the bathroom. Who knows? All of that ends with a 109-103 Heat victory. The Celtics had 23 turnovers on the night, including 7 from Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown, 40 points on 20 shots, and yet all you can have, like, the imprint in your mind of Jaylen Brown's game last night was just how many reckless turnovers he had, how loose his handle was. And, you know, this is a game, it sounds like Jimmy's going to be fine for game four. So, like, this is a game that the Celtics really had to win. If Jimmy Butler is not going to play in a half, like, I don't care that you're down 15. There is no excuse to lose this game. It's a testament to the Heat, who's really cranked up the intensity defensively. The Celtics just, I mean, the play at the end of the game where Kyle Lowry steals the inbound pass was just, like, a perfect encapsulation of what happened. Like, that was the story of game three. The Celtics just did not approach every single possession like it was their last, and the Heat did. So assuming, like, again, we don't, this could be you know, like Nick Stauskas might be starting in the second half of game four at this rate. You know, like we don't know who's going to be healthy, but let's assume all the guys who got banged up in game three are playing in game four. What do the Celtics need to do? Is it as simple as just stop being so careless with the ball?
That's one area for sure. And also Jason Tatum needs to prove something.
I saw this from you. I liked it.
Yeah. Well, look, we had this conversation on the pod last time. Like, remember when I raised this issue? Like, I don't think he's in that tier. Everyone is crowning him so soon. And it's not, again, I want to preface this by saying I'm a huge Jason Tatum fan. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to crap on that guy whatsoever. I love, love, love his game. He is one of the smoothest scorers I have ever seen. And I've been following this league for the quarter of a century. Like, love him. But I think it's so harsh against him to put those expectations on him as, oh, you're in that same category as Luka, Giannis, as Jokic. Like, no, don't put that on him. I don't think mm-hmm. that's fair. I don't think it's fair to come in with that level of expectation put on him. The Celtics have great talent up top, but they also have great depth. Like, I was talking with someone about this on Twitter. Like, imagine Luka in place of Tatum here. Like, imagine Luka having this supporting staff. Mm-hmm. Are we even going to pretend like the Mavericks wouldn't be the odds-on title favorites? I
mean, yeah,
they would be, and that's all fair. But even so, all that aside, he just has too many of those, you know, 4-14 or 4-19 or whatever the hell it is. Like the small percentage games where he turns the ball over, he doesn't really engage offensively. Like, to his credit, I actually think he still participated well defensively, so it's not like he just curled up in fetal position. So, mm-hmm. like, that's good on him. But I'm going to need to see something else. If his jump shot is not falling, he's going to need to assert himself and get to the free throw line. I mean, what is he, 6'8", 220? Somewhere along those lines? Like, give me one single reason why he could not, you know, dribble or cut or do something to get himself towards the basket and just get to the free throw line or get layups. Like, that has to be the counter instead of relying so much on the pull-ups. So that's mm-hmm. one thing. Also, I think the Celtics misread what was going to happen here in game three. Bam Adebayo, you kind of knew he was going to check into this series eventually. Mm-hmm. Like, he had, what was it? Was it 16 total points?
Yes.
After the first two. And, like, let's just be honest. He'd been really disappointed. He had taken a total of 10 shots in the first two games. 10 shots! Like, you have to assume at some point that he's going to assert himself. That he is going to get that Coach Spo, you know, talk. Or maybe even the Jimmy talk. Like, maybe Jimmy put him aside, like, bam! I swear to God, man, I'm not going to give you any of my coffee if you don't, like, come on. And what did he have in the first quarter? Was it 12?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Yeah, right? 10 or 12 points? And it was, like, the vast majority of those came very early, and they came on him just being aggressive. And to me, if I'm the Celtics, I kind of know, I prepare myself for that. I understand mm-hmm. that he's had two rough games. There's no chance in hell he's going to come out just as passive. And it just seemed like it totally freaked them out. Like, wait, what? Bam is scoring? Like, guys, this dude still averaged 19 in the regular season. Like, maybe just game plan for it. There was just no reaction to it. Like, oh, wow. And it opened everything up. And I just don't know if they were prepared enough. So I'm willing to some extent to just call this game the perfect storm for the Celtics. Like, they had mm-hmm. injuries. They had Tatum having one of those his bad games. And then they had, you know, Bam going off on the other end, and they were just totally unprepared for it. I expect to see a much more locked-in Celtics team for game four. And I think at the end of the day, locked in and having that mentality with you is ultimately the only change you need. I mean, schematically and play design wise, they played like they used to. I couldn't fault them for the way they ran their offense. Like, it was just a bad game. It happens.
Yeah. I mean, I think this was from ESPN Stats and Info, and I don't have the exact tweet pulled up, so forgive the generalization here, but it was something along the lines of like the Celtics shot, I think like 52 or 53% on jumpers in game two, which was their best mark in any playoff game since 2014, I believe. So, you know, when the jumpers are falling like they were in game two, the Celtics look completely unbeatable.
Right.
They were not falling to that extent against Miami. And, you know, again, part of it was just like Miami really ratcheted up the defensive pressure and knew we can't allow this many open jumpers, so we're going to cut off passing lanes. And they did time and again, especially in the second half. I mean, Victor Oladipo was just everywhere, it seemed. And, you know, I don't have the half court numbers in the second half in front of me, but I'm assuming Miami's half court rating overall in that game, especially once Jimmy left, was not spectacular. But, you know, they just kept generating points off of turnovers. I think they had 33 off of turnovers. And in a, you know, a 6-point game, they had, the Heat had 22 more field goal attempts than the Celtics did. The Celtics out rebounded them, you know, 30 free throw attempts to 14. Like, a lot of things are pointing, you know, you look at the box score other than the shot attempts and you think like, wow, the Celtics probably won this game handily. And then you see the turnovers and the field goal attempt disparity.
Yeah.
And like, that was that. I'm glad you brought up Bam, because yes, he was phenomenal in game three. And like, as you said, was a complete no-show in games one and two. How much do you think this was getting Kyle Lowry back? Like, him now having a natural pick and roll partner instead of, you know, with all due respect to Gabe Vincent, he's not that guy.
Well, I mean, some, of course, but I also, you know, I mean, let's be honest here. Some of those points were generated off of very traditional post-ups. I mean, so that was just, you know, him getting the ball in the post. Doesn't really matter who makes that entry pass as long as he gets the ball. So, yeah, like, some of it played a part for sure. But I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, yeah, it was all Kyle Lowry. Like, it was all the intangibles brought on by Kyle Lowry. Like, no, it's Bam was outright more assertive all of the way through. Like, he wanted to get those shots. He had this in the middle of the first. He had this weird mid-range pull-up. And I was like, yes, take it, take it. And then it looked very off. And it was like, oh, what did I just talk him to? What did I talk him into? And then it hit bottom. So it was like, oh, okay, he's on that kind of roll. Fair.
Yeah.
Like, he was feeling it. And I think for him, it's about more so than a lot of other players. I think it's about rhythm for him. And if Kyle Lowry is a part of creating or establishing that level of rhythm for him, great. Like, sometimes, I don't remember who said this, and this is years ago, like 20 plus years. I just remember a quote, an NBA quote from many, many years ago of someone saying, I need that guy on the court just because I'm familiar with it. I think the player in question was Lindsey Hunter. It might have been back when he was with the Bucks. It was about Lindsey Hunter. I'm actually sure it was about Lindsey Hunter, but I don't remember who player said it. But basically, the player said, when Lindsey is on the floor, that's when I know that I can do certain things. Like, it's a part of my rhythm to have him on the floor. And when he's missing games or whatnot, it just throws me off. Mm. Maybe there's something something to that thought that we as observers and analysts just can't really comprehend because they're not out there.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's an interesting subplot. It's an interesting development. And, like, let's be honest, the Heat are going to need this level of production from Bam moving forward. Like, if he comes back in game four with one of those game one, game two performances, that's such a waste. He needs to build on this.
Yeah, especially because we don't know, even if Jimmy plays, is he going to be able to, like, single-handedly lift the team like he had been in the first couple of games, or is he going to need more from the supporting cast? We won't know until Monday.
How do they win this game, Brian, by the way, without, you know, or really, how are they up 2-1 in the series with Tyler Hero just not being an offensive factor?
That's what, I've got two things I'm really looking for in game four.
Yeah.
One is, what do the Heat do with Tyler Hero? Because, I mean, Spo pulled him early in the fourth quarter last night, and I don't believe he came back out on the floor in that. I you know, maybe it's because they had the lead the whole time and they knew we need more defensive minded guys to protect this lead rather than like we're playing catch up and we need, you know, Hero or Duncan Robinson, who they dusted off briefly. Like, you know, we need to just play catch up and beat them with a volume of threes. But yeah, like what is their closing lineup moving forward? Or, you know, how much does Hero play over Oladipo or Oladipo play over Hero? Man.
I don't know. I mean, maybe we should just look at Hero first and foremost, because it's not just this series. He's been bad in the playoffs, like all the way through. He is shooting 23.2% from range in the playoffs this year. And that's over 14 games, like 14 games, Brian, that's not a small sample size. Like that, that would be a significant chunk of the regular season.
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, the Sixers were like doubling him because they knew he couldn't pass out of it and they just did not want him to get loose. But, you know, the Celtics have the luxury defensive personnel they have.
Right.
They don't need to do that. They can defend him straight up and he's still struggling.
1 of 14 this series from range. It's just good. he's shooting 7.1% from range in this series.
Yeah, I just looked. So he was the start of the fourth quarter. He was on from the start until the 8 minute mark, or 8:10. They were a -6 in that time, and then he did not play again for the rest of the game.
Yeah,
it was.
I don't know. Oladipo, something needs to happen.
Tucker. Yeah, Oladipo, Tucker, Adebayo, Lowry, and then Struce for almost all of it.
Yeah. Something needs to happen here. Like, we were talking about the Heat not being able to generate enough offense in the half court. That was the reasoning for us that we doubted that they would make a finals run.
Yeah.
The fact that they're up 2-1 with one of their best on-ball creators struggling to the extent that he is amazing.
Yeah.
But it's not going to continue if they don't get more offensive production. At some point, you just need guys to step up, hit shots, create opportunities, and because otherwise you're putting everything on Jimmy, just everything on him, and that's too much. So I don't know what kind of schematic changes you make. I really don't know. I don't know if you go out and basically say, okay, Tyler, we're going to use you entirely different. We're going to use you primarily as a decoy. We're going to have you running off screens like you're freaking Duncan Robinson. Or maybe they give him the ball in his hands and they just set a ton of screens, like more than they're accustomed to, and basically guide him to the basket. I don't know the answer, but they can't have those games where it's either Tyler Hero or Bam Adebayo. Like it always seems with the Heat that you always have one guy who's struggling. And like, I certainly expect the Celtics to come out like gangbusters in game four. So if you're
I mean, like we saw game two as well.
Right. I mean, if you're the Heat, you need to prepare because the Celtics is going to come out and punch you in the freaking teeth right from the get-go in the first quarter. So you need to have that offense going. I don't know if it's Bam you go to early or if it's Jimmy, depending on how he feels, or if you bring in Hero early in the first and let him cook, or hell, maybe you just give the ball to Kyle Lowry and let him make decisions. I don't know the answer. I guess we'll find out. But while I love the defensive unit, I would struggle in being optimistic with what was that lineup you just mentioned? Max Strus, PJ Tucker, Bam?
Yeah, it was Strus, Lowry, Bam, Tucker, Oladipo.
Oof. I mean, that's not a lot of spacing and it's not a lot of offense.
Yeah.
Because,
I mean, like, you know, you'll replace Jimmy with probably Oladipo in that group, Depot, or Lowry, depending on how his hamstring's holding up.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I like that better, but that's also like a significant step up. Like, you'll replace Victor Oladipo with Jimmy Butler. Oh, yeah. That's not insignificant. That's like,
right. The other thing for me is, you know, watching that game and, like, he wouldn't have helped with the turnovers, but Robert Williams did not play last night. I haven't seen if there's been an update yet for his status at game four. It seems like he's just kind of been nursing this knee injury and has been in and out of the lineup all playoffs. So, you know, I would assume he's going to play, that's based on no sourced information. It's just like he knows they can't give away both games at home and expect to win the series. Again, he's not going to help much with like them turning the ball over 24 times, but you know, I don't understand, like, why did they start Daniel Theis last night? I know he only played 10 minutes or whatever, but like, I didn't get that at all. And that seemed to really open the door for Miami to get off to such a hot start. Like,
Miami's not big. Why? What's wrong with Theis? Like, theoretically, what's wrong with Theis?
Miami's not big. Why do you need to go double bigs right away?
I mean, he's 6'8", like, and he's pretty mobile for a big, so-called big. Like, Theis isn't some, you know, 6'11", non-mobile big. Like, he's very fluid. Would you even count him, like, as a traditional big?
I mean, I wouldn't count him as a forward. I wouldn't count him as a center, but, I would count him as a big.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, I guess. I think I like his movement enough to, I understand like the logic of it. Even though he didn't shoot the ball a whole lot, theoretically he can still hit the three, he can still space the court, he can still pass the basketball, he plays a high caliber of defense, he switches well. Like, I understand the logic in doing so. Just didn't work out.
I mean, if they're going to play Grant Williams 40 minutes, like, why not just start him right away?
Because they're saving him for later?
I guess so, but like how much? There was only 9 minutes he didn't play.
Yeah. Like, no, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I mean,
if Time Lord comes back, like I don't,
right.
You know, they'll probably start him and you just aren't going to see Daniel Theis unless there's garbage time. So that should at least help, you know, prevent Miami from jumping out to such an enormous lead in the first quarter.
Right. And the double duo big certainly didn't limit Bam.
No, not at all.
I wonder, like, I realize that I am right now, I'm daring to question the church of Grant Williams, who right now is getting insane love on social media, which great. I do wonder if you had put Grant on Bam, if that had even had an effect. Bam was in that zone.
Yeah, like, he was.
I don't think necessarily that putting Grant on Bam would have done much of anything necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, it does make me wonder, you know, again, if Time Lord is back, does Bam have that type of impact in game four? Or did he go off specifically because Time Lord was not there last night?
I think it's one of those things where, like, he wouldn't have had a game one or game two impact regardless of Time Lord's presence or not. Like, he still would have been better. But it's fair to question, would he have dropped 30-plus if Time Lord had been around? Like, or would Time Lord at least have affected the outcome to the point where he might have scored in the low 20s? And that's legitimately a fair question. That would have swung the entire game. So it's very fair. And that's, again, where I come back to the whole, where does Miami generate enough in the half court, especially when Boston is fully back and healthy.
Right. Yeah, I mean, to me, this exposed that, you know, I think Boston, when fully healthy, is the best team left in these playoffs. But it shows me that if any of their key rotation members are out, so Smart and Horford in game one, Time Lord in game three,
right.
You know, Derek White was the one exception, but I wouldn't count him as a key rotation member.
By the way, why were we crapping? I know you and I weren't, but why were people crapping on Derek White for skipping the game when he was expecting the arrival of his first child, he and his wife's first child? Like, what are we doing?
I would like to see the Venn diagram of people who were doing that and then people who were married and or have kids.
Yes.
Because I feel like there is zero overlap.
Yeah.
Why did he miss the game? So his wife didn't murder him for the next 50 years they spent together. That's why.
Oh, well, that, and also, you know, to experience one of the life's biggest highs of being a parent, becoming a parent for the first time. Like, Wow. Yeah. That just, I don't know why I'm surprised. I shouldn't be surprised. I really shouldn't, because of course people are going to complain about it, but they shouldn't. That was, all right.
It was a predictably gross reaction from Celtics fans. But
congratulations
I mean
to the White family.
Yes, yes. I mean, ultimately that did not matter. But, you know, it tells me that, like, all of these guys are so key that if one of them misses time,
right,
you know, suddenly they are much more flimsy, whereas Miami is so much more a bunch of interchangeable parts. And, you know, I think Miami and Golden State in that regard too are just so flexible and versatile and adaptable that they can, you know, change their lineups, change their rotations to react to what's going on in a given game. So, okay, Tyler Hero isn't hot tonight, but we've got a lead. Cool. We'll go with Oladipo and we'll go with a more defensive minded group where, you know, okay, we need to play catch up. We've got Vincent Hero Robinson, even Caleb Martin, who we can tap in on, you know, Martin in a, didn't play a ton last night, but hit a couple big shots for them. So I know the stat going around is, you know, the Celtics have won what they've either won or broken even in 10 of 12 quarters of this series, but they're down 2-1 right now. So, you know, they might be the better team on paper, but it might not matter if they aren't fully healthy for the rest of this series. The one other thing that I'm interested in seeing, you know, game three, obviously very, very physical, especially from Miami's perspective. And the Celtics, Ime Udoka talked after the game about how that kind of caught them off guard or they didn't respond well to the physicality. So, you know, game four is going to be even more physical in that regard. But, you know, if our officiating crew has a tighter whistle than they did in game three, mm-hmm. how does that affect things moving forward? Like, I know Smart and Grant Williams both fouled out in game three, but Max Strus was the only Heat player to really get in any semblance of foul trouble. But, you know, if Bam picks up a couple early ones, or Jimmy, if he's playing, picks up a couple early ones, like, there are just so many different things that, you know, like on paper, I'm still leading the Celtics in this series, but the Heat, you know, to their credit, like as much as you want to crap on the Celtics for being that careless with the ball last night, like the Heat forced them into a lot of those turnovers.
Yeah. We have to ask one big question though. And we kind of talked about it, you and I, before the beginning of this series.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Celtics lost to the Heat in the bubble in the manner that they did.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's something like a mental control here, like a mental thing that's playing a part? Because I don't know, the Heat seem to get themselves under people's skin. More so than many other franchises.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that plays a part in all this, or if it's, like you said, mostly just injury related.
I don't think it's a mental block necessarily. I just think, I mean, we said this going back to the offseason, mm-hmm. that this was the personnel that the Heat had. That's a playoff defense. Like, they are just going to be annoying to play against and overly physical and not let you get anything easy. And that was the case in game three. And, you know, like the Celtics were just trying to pass around the perimeter and the Heat were like, nope, we're going to dart to every passing lane and then we're going to run out. And that's how we're going to generate offense, especially when Jimmy's out. Like, you're right. We can't beat you in the half court, but we don't need to in this game. So it like, if the Celtics can just be smarter, and maybe that means fewer passes, and maybe you start having to iso Tatum and Brown and even Smart more. Who knows, Marcus Smart will take that opportunity at a moment's notice. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be so interesting to see. Just, I feel like we're going to be able to tell who's winning the game within the first few minutes of game four. Like, where if the Celtics continue to be as flummoxed by the Heat's physicality as they were in game three, I don't know, man. The series, it might be going Heat, but before we move to Warriors Mavericks, what would be your updated prediction?
Oh God, I hate it when you do this. My
I had to. Prediction. I had to. But like, you know, now we have data to react to.
We do. I mean, I had Celtics in six.
Yeah.
Which means they have to win three straight.
Right.
I'm not saying they can't do it.
Two of the next three are at home.
Right. Celtics in seven. I'm gonna give myself a little leeway here.
I'm leaning that way too.
Yeah.
But that is all just dependent, honestly, on both teams. Like, tell me the starting lineups for the next four games, and then I can tell you who I think is going to win the series. But like,
yeah.
You know, who isn't hurt in this series right now? Like Tatum and Smart, Jimmy, Kyle, PJ Tucker like everyone is banged up. So just like which team limps to the finish line the best at this rate?
I feel as though that is the end of many different NBA seasons.
Yeah.
Where it's really honestly. The healthiest team. Yeah. I wonder if the NBA would actually stand to benefit by having like a week off in between regular season and playoffs. Like a real week, not like a few days. Like 7 days.
Right?
No, they don't.
It's Sunday to Saturday, isn't it? For the non-playing teams?
Yeah, for the non-play, I'm saying like even after the play-in, just give it a week.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, neither of these teams were the play-in. That wasn't the issue. It's just like NBA playoff basketball is just a lot more physical than the regular season. Like I know a lot of people have harped on this, and it's come up with the Sixers and Embiid too, in particular, and it like. A lot of these injuries that are happening aren't overuse injuries or like aren't the compilation of multiple seasons, or maybe they are, but it just seems like guys are getting elbowed in the face or guys are coming down hard. Like, you know, like it's just a freak injury that happens. And they're just, it's because guys are playing so much harder on both ends of the court. So I hear you. Like it's crazy to me that, you know, some teams get more time off in the first round. Like you have some series that have like 2 day breaks between games, and in the conference finals it's every other game,
right?
Because at this point in the playoffs, like everyone's worn down. So you're right, a lot of this is just a battle of attrition. It like starts to feel more like the NFL than the NBA in that regard. I don't know what the solution is here.
That said, I am still very much against even having to go to the review just when someone gets elbowed in the face,
yeah,
like going up for a layup.
Yeah.
Like, look, it's part of the shooting. I usually don't agree much with Jeff Van Gundy, but when he said the elbow is a part of the body, like, yeah, it is. That's actually a very, very fair comment. Like, the constant reviews, I don't know. I would just like to see that it doesn't become just a question of who's mostly healthy.
Yeah.
And one solution to that could be not making it best of seven, but like making it best of five, but then the NBA would lose money and I would suddenly go missing if I kept.
Right. Therein lies the problem.
Yeah.
All right. Let's switch to Warriors Mavericks. Game three is tonight. The Warriors have jumped out to a 2-0 lead in this series. Blew the doors off the Mavericks in game one. Game two is going to hurt if the Mavericks end up losing this series because they had a massive lead for most of the first half. Maintained double digit lead for almost all of the third quarter. Warriors finally start coming back at the end of the third and then just go on one of their vintage Warriors run in the fourth quarter. I think there are two things that stood out to me in game two. One, the Mavericks seem to be trying to switch on to Kevon Looney and attack him in the second half, which just did not work at all. So I'm going to assume they're just not going to pursue that strategy. I don't understand why they're not attacking Klay Thompson more.
They did for a while. You're saying why they don't milk it more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that should be the strategy.
Yeah. And honestly, Steph too, to some extent. especially when Luka is the guy. Like, if you're trying to get the matchup of Luka going on Steph, I love Steph, and he's got quick hands, but Luka's got like 50 pounds on him. Like, I'll take that. Yeah, I'm not sure. And I think part of it, like, Luka basically said this after the game as well. Like, they were relying a little bit more on the three, and that was a mistake. I think they got so hot. They hit 15 first half threes in game two.
Yeah.
Which was a franchise record, if memory serves. And then they still kept that strategy going where I kind of saw that, like, those wheels falling off when they started missing in third quarter. And I was, like, waiting for the adjustment to come. Like, now, okay, you've hit all those outside shots. They're sprinting out to you at this point. Like, just get to the basket. Go more to the basket. And it didn't happen. And I don't want to be simplistic because there's more to it than just that. But you do need to have different looks. And if they become too predictable in seeking that three, I don't know what that says about their chances long-term in the series.
Yeah, I mean, I think they went 2 of 13 from three in the third quarter, if I'm remembering correctly.
It was a very ghastly shooting performance in the third for both teams, but the Mavericks stood out. Yeah,
right. Like, the Warriors weren't making them pay for a while, but then finally started to. Right. But yeah, that was the other thing that stood out to me, was especially in the fourth quarter, you know, the Mavericks were attacking Luka on defense every single time. They were trying to get him switched onto someone, usually Steph.
Yeah.
And then he would, you know, sprint back to cover whoever was in the paint, usually Looney at that point. But that would send the Mavericks defense scrambling into a rotation, and the Warriors just had a layup line every single time.
Right.
But you're right. Like, the Mavericks just lived and died by the three. Luka was like the only one who was really able to generate anything in the paint for most of that game.
Brunson had his moments here and there, but he actually embraced the shooting in game two, which I like to see, though. I don't think it was all bad, because I do think if that duo is going to play alongside each other for years to come, Brunson needs to be more assertive in taking spot up threes. Because, of course, you have to benefit from the attention that Luka gets. Like, not taking more threes has always been a problem for Brunson, if you ask me. So I love to see him embrace that. But he needs to find a balance. Mm-hmm. Like, he is so sturdy, so strong, that I would have no problem with seeing him go down in the post against Steph. Like, he lives on that block for a guy who's like 6'1". And nobody seems to be able to actually, you know, remove him from the paint. He just keeps using those little bulldozers of shoulders and backing people in. I like that approach, but I would also like to see him pass out of the post a little bit more. I would like to see him utilize his passing skills when he gets down there, because you kind of know what's going to happen. Like, he's going to try for that little turnaround, and either it's going to be a fade or it's going to be an up and under. Like, it's beginning to be easy to sniff out. Like, if you add a passing component to it and you have guys who cut a little bit more, the thing is, though, who is that? Like, Dorian Finney-Smith, who is going to cut? Like, Reggie Bullock is not going to cut. He's going to pop every single time. Who's going to cut? Maxi Kleber? Davis Bertans? Like, hell no. All those guys are outside. So I just wonder, is there enough off-ball action from inside the three-point line to make up for all the makes outside? I don't think so. I still think they need a wing, like a proper wing who can slash the basket either with or without the basketball.
Yeah, I don't know if Tim Hardaway Jr. is that guy, but this is the first time in the playoffs where you're really noticing his absence.
Yes, agree.
But I mean, even Jason Kidd after the game, and Luka said, you know, Kidd said they just lived and died by the three. God, his quote, you know, if you make threes, that's great, but you just have to understand, if you miss four in a row, you can't take the fifth. You just got to make it. That just puts too much stress on yourself and your team. And it's like, isn't that what the opposite of what, like, literally every shooter and every coach says? So that was just funny. But I mean, Luka
remember his nickname, Ace and Kid, right?
I know. Yeah. So maybe he's still got part of a mental block with regard to shooting there. But Luka did say, yeah, we weren't attacking the paint that much. We got to attack it more like they did. They attacked the paint a lot. They have two of the best shooters in the world. They still attack the paint. So, I mean, part of it is, you're right, like, personnel-wise, I don't know if they have the right people to do that. Like, as much as I love Dorian Finney-Smith, I think the Warriors will live with Dorian Finney-Smith driving and attacking the paint. Or, you know, the benefit of a Maxi Kleba, that he is able to knock down the three. Not what I would think of as, like, a traditional pick-and-roll big. So,
Why not, though? That surprises me that you say that. You watched the Mavs as I did back when they had that year, 2 years ago, when they broke, what was it, the offensive rating record?
Yeah.
And they had the best.
Yeah.
Like, I've been harping on this podcast as well. He was used more in the short roll. Like, they actually used him, and then when he got to that free throw line, he would either attack, and he could put down some just insane dunks, or he would make that kick out to the corners for a shooter. I mean, he has taken nothing but 3-point shots this year. He's 2 of 9. Mm-hmm. Maxi Kleber, to me, is still grossly misused, and I don't understand why it's continuing under a second coach. It seems like the perception of Kleber has just changed to, oh, yeah, he was this do-it-all big who could both pop but also roll, pass in the short roll, finish short roll, jump shots and push shots. Like, he was such a versatile big, and now it's like, oh, yeah, he's Lauri Markkanen. Like, what are we doing here? Like, I think it's wrong to say that he's not a pick-and-roll player. He's just not being used like that anymore, which blows my mind. It's so apparent that they need more production on the interior. So why not use a guy who is like, what, 6'10", 6'11", and then just go in there and get stuff done?
Yeah, I mean, this might be one of the downsides to having such a Luka-centric offense, is that all of these other guys are just in much smaller roles. Like, you're totally right. Maybe Kleba is capable of doing more. Maybe Finney-Smith is capable of doing more, but they just aren't used to playing that way and haven't played that way all year. So, like, can you really count on them to totally change, you know, heading into Game 3 of the conference finals? Or is this just, you know, you are what you are at this point, and you just have to pray you can outshoot the Warriors or out-execute the Warriors? Like, now, the Warriors, to their credit, you know, one of the reasons I was skeptical, or at least thought this would be a closer series than it has been so far, is I thought, you know, the Warriors have not been very clean. Like, they made a bunch of dumb mistakes against Memphis throughout that series. They played very well in these two games. So I think, you know, maybe as they get closer to, you know, further along in the playoffs, closer to an actual championship, they're really starting to lock in and take their opponent much more seriously now. Not that they weren't against Memphis. Memphis had a couple matchups that were really bad for them, but you're right. They, especially when Ja went down, they probably weren't taking them very seriously for a game or two. You know, they know Luka, you know, might genuinely be the best player in the series and deserves that level of fear and healthy respect. I don't know. I don't know what the Mavericks do from here, other than, you know, like, in Game 1, it was a blowout in favor of the Warriors, but in the first half, the Mavericks were generating good looks. They just weren't falling. And then Game 2,
oh, in Game 1, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Game 2, they were falling for the first half. And even in Game 2 in the third quarter, when they went cold, like, I didn't have a problem with a lot of the threes they generated. It's just like the shots stopped falling. And we said coming into the series, you know, a lot of this is two of the highest volume 3-point shooting teams in the playoffs. Whichever one makes their shots is probably going to go on and advance to the finals.
Yeah.
You know, the Mavericks right now are shooting 34.4 from deep. The Warriors are shooting 42.1, so it's productive. Look at
their overall field goal percentage, the Warriors. Yeah,
56.1. So, I mean, it's reductive to boil it down just to that, but, you know, it, like, Did the Mavericks get a single stop in the fourth quarter?
Not off the top of my head.
Yeah, it didn't feel like they. I'm sure they got one or two, but like.
Yeah, but there's not like one that stands out. But I think in fairness, it's also more easy to remember like proper stops when someone like has a major block or has a major defensive play. And the Mavericks don't really have those guys who make, don't get me wrong here, highlight defensive plays. Like, where is that elite shot blocker? They don't have one. They don't have someone who just continuously blows up pick and rolls. Like, they have very competent, very reliable, and consistent defenders in Dorian Finney-Smith, Maxi Kleber, but those guys, Reggie Bullock, that's fine, but none of them are disruptive. Like, and that's what I say when I think they need a wing. It's not just a wing on the one end. Like, they need a two-way wing. Mm. You know, I had this thought the other day, like, back when Dirk won the ring in 11. Like, just how big of a luxury the presence of Sean Marion was. Mm. Like, he could guard 3 to 4 positions. Mm-hmm. Like, he could definitely guard both forwards and center, but he could even slide down and guard a two. Like, he was that quick. And he would blow up pick and rolls. He would blow up attacks to the rim. He would get out to run, and he would finish plays in transition. Like, that's the type of player they need alongside Luka at this point. Like, and that's all respect to Dorian Finney-Smith. He's not that guy. Like, I love Dorian Finney-Smith. I think he's on a good contract. I think you should stick around. Mm-hmm. They need, like, a proper wing who can just really create havoc.
So I was being somewhat facetious when I asked, did they get a stop in the fourth quarter? Warriors shot 15 of 19 in the fourth quarter, 5 of 7 from deep, including a made 3 from Draymond Green. Yeah. But the Mavericks were 9 of 15, 4 of 5 from deep, 10 of 11 from the free throw line. Like, they scored 32 points in the fourth quarter. That most nights will get it done. They only had 3 assists on their 9 made baskets. The Warriors had 11 assists on their 15. It just, like, they need to figure out, like, let's go into game 4. They've got to figure out a way, if we've got a close game in the fourth quarter, how are we going to defend or protect Luka? Like, maybe the solution is just don't scramble Luka. Like, if Luka gets switched onto Steph, just live with it, see what happens. Because the alternative was just them running a layup line. Like, Stan Van Gundy was on the broadcast, like, okay, it's, you know, they've got a 7-point lead. Like, there's still plenty of time left. They just need to start stringing together some stops. And then the Warriors scored. And then the next time down the floor, it's like, okay, we still got time left, but they just need to start stringing together. And he just repeated himself for like 4 minutes as they did not get a single stop in that span.
And that's the problem, right? They had a very strong defense in the regular season. I don't think it's falling short right now. I think a large component of this also just the Warriors shooting lights out. I mean, Jordan Poole is hitting like 68% from the field. Like, and also, like, Kevon Looney.
Yeah, man.
Look, when you don't have a proper two-way center in Dallas, like a real center, like, there, let's be real here. Maxi Kleber, that's fine. Like, you can put him in at center. He's probably mostly a forward. You're really only limited to Dwight Powell, who you're playing like 10 minutes per game.
Yeah.
But when you have a guy like Kevon Looney who recognizes that and goes, oh, I'm the best center in the series, I should just see what I can do. And he goes in and he's averaging like 16, 9, and 3 for the series. That's such a backbreaker for Dallas, because how are you going to respond to that? If you're already getting production from the perimeter, you're already getting production from the wings, and now all of a sudden you have to take care of a center who's giving you 16 points per game. Like, where's the response going to be? Like, is it just more Luka? Because that's not going to work out for anyone.
I mean, I don't know how much more you can realistically ask out of a guy who had 42, 8, and 5.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
23 shots.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So for me, the question is, how can they generate, if this is all about trading baskets, which is always the fear with Golden State. Like, Golden State can get hot against any elite defense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, even if they're gonna meet Boston in the playoff in the finals, they can still have a game where they go out and they shoot 60% against Boston. That's just how they're wired. So sometimes it comes down to how do we fight fire with fire? And looking at the roster construction in Dallas, I just don't think they have that right now. I mean, one thing was, and that, you know, I picked Dallas coming into the series because I thought, okay, look, the trajectory of the Warriors, it seems to be down. Like, they didn't care. They were out of sorts. There was no rhythm going on. Like, it was just an unnecessarily long second round. It didn't seem like they were in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now they flipped that switch, like you said.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. So how do you respond to that if you're Dallas? What's the switch that you flick here? What is that? Do they even have it? Or is that already on? Because it's been on for the entire season.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are probably some minor schematic tweaks, like when the Warriors go to a zone, don't play Frank Ntilikina. That really seemed to help the Warriors in the first half.
You're just putting your friendship with Dan on
the test here. I know. But, I mean, he has to acknowledge that was not a great stint from Frankie Smokes. What was he? Was
okay, it? He played, sure. He, yeah, let, he played let's three. Ask Dan to be reasonable about Frankie Smokes. Okay.
Fair point. Well, he put up a Greg Monroe-esque minus 10 in 3 minutes and 32 seconds of playing time in game two. So
yeah,
the numbers don't lie there. Yeah, but otherwise, I mean, they're playing the right guys. This isn't like a low-hanging Daniel Theis fruit. Like, oh, why, you know.
Right.
Maybe you just go with Kleba right away. Like, I mean, Powell played less than 8 minutes in total, but maybe you just don't start him at all and go with Kleba from the jump.
Right.
But, like, other than that, I mean, like, Dinwiddie is the only guy that you can really even remotely count on off the bench if Kleba moves into the starting lineup, that is.
Yeah. So I sort of agree with you. And the only reason I only sort of agree with you is because I fully recognize what your comeback is going to be to this suggestion.
Okay.
Davis Bertans. And yeah. So hear me out here. Okay. I don't think a shooter is going to get enough of a rhythm set when playing as limited minutes as he is.
Mm-hmm.
What if you gave him a crack at it? Like, you basically come in to game three and you say, look, you have 28 minutes. Like, I'm going to get, like, whatever. Oof. Like, okay. 25, whatever. Just more than 10, for fuck's sakes. You know what I mean, right?
Yeah, sure.
And you just say, just run. Bend that defense all the way that you can. Make yourself available in the corners. Make yourself available above the break. Make yourself available everywhere around the three-point line and never stop running. I don't know if that does anything, but I would like to see that being given a legitimate attempt.
My only, I mean, you know the counter, but the obvious counter is they are going to run at him every single play until they play him off the floor, and it's not going to take that long.
All right, but this is where I'm at. Again, what if he then starts to produce offensively? What if he doesn't lose that matchup? What if
he has to, I understand that,
but what if he plays 20 minutes and hits five goddamn threes?
Yeah.
And he gives up 10. Then he's scored 15, he's given up 10. That's a one matchup right there.
That seems optimistic for Thomas Bertans to only give up 10 points in 20 minutes.
Giving up 10 points, that's fair. Yeah. But you catch my drift, though. Bridge that gap. As opposed to a lot of other situations where, like Maxi Kleber right now, playing 26 minutes per game, scoring 3 points. He scored a grand total of 6 points in this series. Are you going to tell me that Maxi Kleber has not given up more than 6 points over the course of these two games?
Yeah, I'm sure he has.
All right, then he's lost this matchup.
Sure.
Significantly, probably, because he was matched up against Andrew Wiggins a couple times, and Wiggins has been decent. I mean, he's been okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, ultimately, the fundamental problem here is beyond Steph and Klay. You know, the Warriors are getting great production out of Looney. They're getting good two-way production out of Wiggins. Draymond is – honestly, Draymond wasn't even that good in Game 2. He was one of the Mavericks' best players. But they're getting great production out of Jordan Poole, as you mentioned. Right. You know, the Mavericks are getting Luka, and Jalen Brunson had a great Game 2. Reggie Bullock has been pretty solid.
Great Game 2, yeah.
Other than that, a fat load of nothing from really the rest of the supporting cast. Like, they just, this is where their depth issues are really becoming problematic.
Right.
But, at, you know, like Dinwiddie in the games 6 and 7 against Phoenix, you know, shot 5 of 7 from deep. Maybe they go home and Dinwiddie has a great shooting game and that helps swing one of these games. But Dinwiddie having 4 points on 2 of 6 shooting and 4 turnovers, it like they're going to be drawing dead most nights if they're getting that little out of everyone else.
You brought up Draymond. Can we just address something here?
Sure.
How was he not thrown out?
Yeah. I wonder how much of it is like his reputation both helps and hurts him in that regard.
Well, it definitely helped him apparently this time around because he stayed in. He had a tech already. He was screaming his lungs out repeatedly.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel as though Van Gundy was so close to saying it at one point, like just toss him. Like you just can't. I don't understand how you as a referee unit, you know, going in and reffing a playoff game cannot have more control there. Like he completely screamed everyone in their heads after having gotten the first tech and they were just okay with it. How is that? Like, how does that set a line for everyone?
I don't know, but again, I wonder if like his reputation and knowing that if he gets thrown out, everyone's going to look at it as like, oh, it's just because he's Draymond Green and no one else would have gotten thrown out. Like anyone would have gotten thrown out if they did that, if they had one technical. But I mean, also maybe no, like if he hadn't already had a tech, he definitely would have gotten a tech there. But like, I don't know. I don't know how much unconscious bias there is of like, do you really want to swing or potentially swing a playoff game by throwing this guy out just because he's yelling at you?
I mean, you can't, if you're the ref, you can't think about that.
Yeah, right. I mean, you shouldn't, but are you?
No, but I mean, if you are, you shouldn't be reffing a game.
It's fair.
But I will say, you're right, because it has worked for him, not worked for him, the opposite. It hasn't worked for him always. Like in the Memphis series, I disagree that he should have gotten thrown out after the Brandon Clark thing. And I think that was totally because he was Draymond. It's almost like he is graded almost entirely due to who is the ref at that any given night. Which, like, so he's graded on a curve in that sense, where I'm just kind of sitting there as an observer thinking, okay, so where is the line? Like, is Luka Doncic then allowed to scream as much as Draymond? Maybe, but what about Maxi Kleber? Mm-hmm. He got screwed on a call, and he would have done the same as Draymond. How quickly would he been out of there?
It's a fair question.
Yeah, I just had a problem with it. I didn't think that was. I think overall, I'm not one of those guys who complain a lot about the refs. You know that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have been less than satisfied with the overall reffing of the entire NBA playoffs.
Yeah, that's fair. Before we move on, updated predictions for this series with the caveat that both of us picked the Mavericks to win coming into the series. God,
I hate you.
Well, I did it too.
Yeah, you did. I think we're both wrong.
Yeah.
I just did not expect the Warriors to come out like this. And in fairness, I don't expect them to keep shooting 56% either. Like, Porter is hitting 82% of his shots, and like Jordan Poole 68%. I don't think that's going to continue. Kevon Looney 79% of his shots. Klay Thompson, 57. Like, that's going to fall down. So I do still think that the Mavericks get on the board. I would be very, very surprised if this was a sweep. And because I said it, it's going to be a sweep now. You
know, right.
So I'm going to say Dubs in six, because I'm still giving Luka two games, damn it.
Yeah, that was my gut updated prediction as well.
Yeah.
It's going to be fascinating to see the defensive schemes with Luka in particular tonight. Like, if the Dubs do start trying to mismatch hunt him, how the Mavericks react, I think. I mean, that's going to be the key to the series moving forward. If they don't come up with a good answer to that, this thing is not going very long. If they do, you know, I know everyone is like, well, they were down 2-0 against the Suns as well. But the Warriors are very different teams. Like, well, the Suns were a 64-win team. And, like, they were, you know, what we thought were the best team in the NBA for pretty much the entire season until they lost. So a 2-0.
Yeah, but they lost in a manner, though. They lost.
I know. And yeah, like, I don't think Stephen Curry is going to turn 37 in this series and then just stop being able to play basketball. Wow. Yeah. But I mean, like, the Mavericks have shown that they've been able to overcome something like this. And as you said, there is some low hanging fruit for them to address, or even just regression to the shooting mean for the Warriors and for them as well. So I'm hyped for game three. I hope it isn't a blowout, because game three of Celtics Heat was trending that way for a while, and then it got really spicy at the end.
Before we wrap up this series, I want to ask you something, because this is something that I can't tell if this bothers me, but it's something that I've taken note of, and I want to hear where you're at. Okay. So everyone is all on the whole, oh, Luka Doncic needs to be a much better defender wagon, which, all right.
Sure.
How much can you expect a single human being to be locked in for, you know, the amount of minutes that he plays? And I'm not asking that in a sarcastic way. I am legitimately asking, because the burden that he carries offensively, the level of responsibility, the amount of touches, the amount of shots, the amount of passes, the amount of overview that he has to have at all times offensively, it is so taxing. It is like, at it has to be one, if not the top two in the league, of the most responsibilities offensively. How much is it fair to expect him to also be dominant, or at least above average defensively, when you're carrying that amount of, you know, that kind of load on the other end of the floor? What is reasonable here?
I don't think it's like you expect him to be on the all defensive team.
Right.
It's just, again, like, is he such a bad defender that they're going to hunt him every time and that they're not going to have an answer for it? Or they're, I mean, if you go back and rewatch the fourth quarter, it is shocking how easy it was for the Warriors to generate, like, wide open attempts at the line.
Again, fourth quarter, out of gas, spent all game just building. I mean, it's just.
And he wasn't. It wasn't him. Like, he wasn't the defender on a lot of those possessions. They switched onto him, and then he scrambled away from the play. But him scrambling and then forcing rotations was where things broke down.
Yeah. I just wonder what, like, the obvious counter, or not the counter, but the obvious thing here is, well, when he drops more of his weight and he's going to be in shape, he's going to have more injury. Okay, that's all fine and well, but he's not going to be Superman. Like, he's not going to have endless stamina. That's not going to work. I mean, players are human beings. They're going to get tired eventually. I just, again, I'm sitting here. I'm looking at this roster. And, like, Jalen Brunson, if he can be this steady 22-point scorer alongside Luka, I think it's going to go a long way in Luka actually turning into a better defender, because he won't have to use up as many possessions offensively.
Yeah.
I just wonder if it's feasible. I wonder if this is somehow, in a way, a little bit of a lost cause, because there's always going to be these expectations put on Luka that, hey, if you're not playing elite defense, you suck. And then we don't care if you have to handle literally everything on the other end.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. All right, Let's go into a couple news items that we have not had a chance to hit between the playoffs and the draft lottery last week. First, the Sacramento Kings have a new head coach. It is Mike Brown, who has spent the last 6 years with the Golden State Warriors as their assistant coach. Before then, he was the Cleveland Cavaliers coach during LeBron's first stint there. And then he came back there for the 13-14 season, also spent slightly more than one season with the Lakers before getting fired very early in his second season there. So what do you think of Mike Brown as the Kings head coach?
I think it beats not hiring Mark Jackson.
That's there you go.
Or it beats hiring Mark Jackson.
I yes, say. Yes, yes, yes.
Sorry. It beats hiring Mark Jackson for sure.
He is not Mark Jackson, therefore it's a
correct. Win. That is a win in and of itself. No, I think it's fine. Like Mike Brown, you know, I never thought of him as a guy who should never have another NBA coaching job. Like I don't think he was one of those guys. I think, yeah, like he did all right by himself to the extent where you would say, yeah, he should get another shot at some point. Mm-hmm. And now he's coming in to a team that has this expectation of making, what was it, a Wolves kind of leap. So basically,
yeah,
they're looking at a 16-game improvement from last year from this year to next year. That's a tall task. And if Mike Brown like signed off on that expectation and said, yes, I can do that, then I wonder how the relationship is going to be next year. Because if Vivek Ranadive is still going to interfere, if he's still going to be a problem, if he's still going to muck up that situation there, then I don't care if you're 55-year-old Greg Popovich. You're not going to stand a chance.
Yeah. So Mark Stein was the one who said, team officials are counting on a Minnesota-esque surge in the standings in year one. The Wolves improved by 23 wins. And Chris Finch's first season, obviously they made the trade for Sabonis at the deadline. They have the number four pick, which depending on who you believe, they are either planning to try to move up in the draft or they are shopping that pick for a veteran. We covered in the last episode how difficult it is to find a trade that might make sense for that type of a player.
Right.
And, you know, the West is... it's not getting any worse next year. Maybe like Utah will be worse, but you know, the Clippers are only going to be better. The Nuggets are only going to be better. I guess we'll see what happened with the Suns, but you know, the Pels are only going to get better if Zion's healthy. The Blazers, at least as of now, are not planning to blow things up completely. Like they want to go right back into contention. The Lakers are going to do their damnedest to do the same thing. So I don't know what the answer here is for the Kings, because I get you tread water forever, but like it just feels weird for this team to be in win now mode when, you know, in theory they switched into it at the trade deadline and then did not actually win now. Like they went they were 22-38 coming out or going into the All-Star break and went 8-14 over their final 22 games.
In fairness, Domantas Sabonis played very, very well as a King. 19 he points, did. 12 rebounds, 6 assists, 55% from the field. Like, there's something there to build on with him and De'Aaron Fox. It's just a matter of, like, what are you going to do with four? Like you said, are you going to flip it? I would assume they are very open to shopping it.
Sure. I would
too. Pardon?
I would too. It's just who makes sense at four? Like who's going to be the member of the big three, the third member of the big three that makes sense? And then you also have to figure out, okay, if you're trading number four, who is the salary matching chip? Is it Rashawn Holmes? Is it Harrison Barnes? Those are really two options. Like John Collins. Like, can the Hawks get like four and Harrison Barnes for John Collins?
That'd be a win. That'd be a,
it'd be a huge win. That's yeah. what I'm saying. Like yeah. four in theory has a lot of value, but it I does. Don't know who's available that has that type of value.
Well, I mean, maybe someone isn't available right now, or we just don't know about it. Like,
sure.
I was thinking about this because I'm still flabbergasted at the fact that rumors persist that Shea Gilgeous-Alexander is not untradeable, because that to me is insanity.
Yeah.
But if that is true.
Yeah, that's fair. Like,
that's a guy right there. Then having a number four pick, and hell, if it's for Shea, I even throw in Davion Mitchell. I don't care. Like,
yeah, I would too.
Go for it. Go for it. Like then a Fox, Shea backcourt, and then Domantas as the big. Give me all of that. But I don't think necessarily that's going to happen, because ultimately I don't believe OKC would be that stupid.
Unless they really like a player at four.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're trading off of Shea and you're getting then the guy you're getting at four has to be better.
Right, right. Yeah, it's the whole like, oh, well, we can take someone at four. They might even be good as Shea Gilgeous-Alexander someday. Yeah.
Like, it's right, and it's preposterous.
Yeah.
I'm looking around, and I'm looking at teams that are just in need of like a rebuild, or are in a rebuild and could just use another draft pick.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of how I look at it, there's not a single team that springs to mind who has like a lot of available established talent.
Right.
Where you think, oh, this makes sense. Like, right. Sure, we can find names that fit, and where you can facilitate a trade, and where we say, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense. But there's not one move where you just go, that's it. That's the one right there.
Right. Right. That's my point. Like, there's not a guy out there who's available and is worth number four. And Shea might be the one exception to that rule if he's actually available.
If but he's like, right. And that's a big ass if.
But like Jeremy Grant should not get you the number four pick. Like
right.
If Sacramento is willing to do, again, you need to do the salary match too. So like, you know, Harrison Barnes at number four Harry at number four for number five and Jeremy Grant shouldn't even do it, I don't think.
I have a weird one here.
Okay.
And I do think, so how to say this? It's Gordon Hayward.
Oh.
No, okay. Not for four. Oh, like okay. The Hornets will have to add in like the 13th or 15th pick.
So Hayward, like, because Hayward's on a big contract, so that would have to be Barnes and Holmes.
Yeah, and then that's why you have to throw in like the two mid tier picks.
Okay, and then Sacramento keeps number four as well.
No, I mean. That was the idea. I don't know how to finagle it. Like, I just thought Gordon Hayward and the use of those two picks from Charlotte.
Honestly,
yeah.
Barnes and Holmes for Hayward and 13?
Is that enough?
Probably not, no. Barnes probably could have got you at least a first on his own at the deadline. He could probably get you a first right now.
But I do, well, see, that's the thing also. I do wonder, if you have to give up Harrison Barnes and you get Gordon Hayward back, does that just nullify the entire idea? Like, is that counterintuitive? Wouldn't you rather have that you go into next season with both those guys? So maybe it's just a dead idea from the start. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, right. Like, this is my concern with, like, the Mike Brown era. The beginnings of the Mike Brown era in Sacramento. If they're in win now mode, in theory, that means number four is well up for grabs, but I'm worried they're going to sell low on number four, put more pressure on them to win right away.
Yeah.
And they're going to be swimming upstream because they were so short sighted.
What about Donovan Mitchell? Again, it's one of those, ooh. Oh, it'd be nice. But again, so here's the thing. Again, the Jazz would have to actively say, screw everything, we're going into full-on rebuild, like full-on.
Right.
And I'm just not sure that they're there.
Yeah. Now, Sabonis and Gobert would be a weird fit, but like Gobert is probably more available. But again, yeah, the salary matching is just so tough.
It is. But I'd be willing to move off of like Harrison Barnes there.
Unless they're willing to move on De'Aaron Fox. Because, I mean, he's the biggest salary by far.
All right. All right. So like a Fox for Mitchell? Seems like a lateral move in a way.
Well, Utah is not saying yes to that.
They aren't. And also, even if they were, like, he's not significantly younger. So it just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Oh, God. I'm going to hate myself for even floating this.
Uh-oh.
Fox and four for Dame.
Wow. That's a significant overpay for Dame, isn't it?
It is. But tell me Sacramento wouldn't do it.
No, they would, wouldn't they? They would.
They absolutely would.
Yeah, they would. They would. But you know what? Who also would do it? Portland, I imagine.
I don't know if they would.
Four and De'Aaron Fox for a guy who is, what, 32? Going to be 32?
Yeah, 31, 32.
He's going to be 32 in July, who's on just a humongous contract.
Yep. It might have had a bigger extension this summer.
Right. Who's had an abdomen problem for, what, 3 or 4 years?
Yep. But he did get surgically corrected. So.
Yeah, that's in fairness. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty clear they shot Fox at the deadline and found no takers.
Yes. Yes. I still think people are sleeping a little bit on Fox. And again, we read that article. I don't remember who wrote it. With players having like the king stink on them.
Right.
I totally buy that.
I do too. Like,
I really do. And it's not fair. If a team out there was smart enough to not get affected by that and could just say, okay, look, De'Aaron Fox is a hell of a player. He just played in an organization for 5 years that had no idea of how to do things. Like this, this is like, this isn't a professional NBA franchise because, like, the top of that leadership board or the ownership board, it's bananas. Why don't you proactively go out then if you're a team that believes in Fox and just goes, yeah, we can fix him. We can save that career and we can turn him into, like, a hell of a player. Like, this,
I think 2 years from now,
he's an all-NBA guy.
Yeah, I think if any team believes it could do that, that would be a smart play.
But I can't believe that a team out there isn't willing to do that. The talent is undeniable. Like, let's be honest here. Like, De'Aaron Fox sometimes gets talked about as if he's a G Leaguer.
I know.
He's extraordinary.
Yeah. I am just, in general, concerned about the Kings' direction.
Yep.
I will believe it when I see it. But the fact they are going into this offseason so gung-ho in win-now mode with this potentially premium asset makes me very worried about what they're going to do with it.
I think they're going to not waste it, but I do think they're going to make a short-term move, which, like, that's fair. Yeah. If it's worth it in the short term, and that's where I have my doubts. I wonder who that player is. You see, honestly, I think out of any team in the league, I think it's Sacramento that's mostly pissed off by the fact that Jaylen Brown and the Celtics turn things
around. Yeah. Well, I bet the Sixers are too.
True, but that's the trade. And like Harrison Barnes plus Rashawn Holmes for Jaylen.
Well, I mean, that was had the Celtics really gone off the rails in January and had they really started to consider, do we need to break up the Jays? Like, that was the Ben Simmons trade.
I would rather have four and Harrison Barnes.
That is very fair.
Okay. By the way, remember that DM I sent you?
Which one?
Because I was kicking back on Friday with some 2K.
Oh, yeah. Did you tweet it out?
I did. I did.
Good.
Brian, I decided to actually go for it. So for people who haven't paid attention, I was just kicking back with some 2K. I hadn't played in a while, and I had this old save, and I was playing like a franchise mode. And it was suggested to me that I needed a shot doctor.
Yep.
And then I went in and I found some of the best shot doctors for my staff. And the highest rated guy who was a shot doctor was Ben Simmons, which is still
not the same guy, just someone named Ben Simmons.
No, it was Ben Simmons.
Oh, that was actually
Was Ben Simmons, because I was in the year 2040 something. Oh, I was like way down the line.
I thought it was just literally someone else named Ben Simmons.
No, no, no. It was actually Ben Simmons. It was actually post-career playing Ben Simmons, who now identifies as a shot doctor. I don't know if the crew at 2K like did something behind the scenes in the coding, but if they did, kudos. Kudos to 2K for that epic troll job.
I didn't even realize, because he has this like ridiculous beard in this screenshot. Wow.
It is him. I was absolutely sure.
Oh, man. And his personality is labeled expressive. That's fantastic. All around well done.
I don't know if it's like just the algorithm that just went up perfect for me. Love that.
Something broke.
Yeah, it was perfect. It was perfect. And you know what? Like what I said, I did hire him.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and my star player, 45% shooting from outside, went down to 29.
Once a Sixer, always a Sixer. All right, let's wrap up with the other, not official news, but seems like it's moving that direction.
Yes.
The Denver Nuggets appear like they might be in some real jeopardy of losing their president of basketball operations, Tim Connolly. He traveled to Minnesota to meet with team owner Glenn Taylor this weekend. They are aiming to make him one of the NBA's highest paid executives, according to ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski. There's a report in the Denver Post from Mike Singer that they are looking to possibly more than double his salary. And there is some speculation that they might be giving or offering him some equity in the team as well.
Right.
Nothing's official yet, but from, you know, we both follow a bunch of Denver folks and they seem correctly very miffed by this news. So,
oh, you're being very, very political right now. Miffed is not the right word.
What do you make of all of this?
Well, when you are known widely as a very strong executive, mm-hmm. but you're being compensated as, you know, as one of the lowest on the totem pole in terms of around the league, I think it's entirely fair that you are curious about your market, sure. that you're looking around, and I think good on Minnesota for stepping up and saying, oh, look, here's a guy who's grossly underappreciated. So let's actually make sure that we appreciate him with the right dollars and cents. And let's even throw in an ownership stake. I mean, that's just good business. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with, if I'm, you know, a Denver fan, is that this would be yet another high-level executive who might end up leaving the franchise. Like, they had Masai Ujiri, went to Toronto and won a championship there. They had Arturis Karnišovas, signed on as team president in Chicago. Like, why wouldn't they try to retain some of their own guys? That, to me, is weird. I don't understand the logic here. Like, if Connolly is going to move on as well, I don't know who's next in line. Maybe it's Calvin Booth. Maybe it's someone else. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes you sure that when that next guy steps up, and even if he does a great job, like let's, for argument's sake, let's say that it's Calvin. He steps up. He does a great job. Then what happens in a couple of years when the Lakers fire Rob Pelinka and they go, hey, Calvin Booth, come on down. Come down to LA.
Yeah. I mean, it's, look, we say it all the time. You know, Danny Leroux of The Athletic says it too. You know, ownership is the biggest competitive advantage in the NBA. Like, if they aren't willing to pay up, someone else is going to.
Right.
You know, the Timberwolves are in the process of switching ownership from Glenn Taylor to Mark Lohr and Alex Rodriguez. Alex Rodriguez made an ungodly amount of money during his baseball career and afterward, I'm sure. So like he, you know, he doesn't have like Steve Ballmer money, but they appear to be willing to spend and spend well on this team. And, you know, it's the NBA is you have a finite salary cap in which to work and you can exceed it, you know, through certain CBA mechanisms. But like, even if you are Steve Ballmer, you can't go out and sign Zach LaVine this summer just because you have more money, right? Like, so there is a set salary cap, which prevents even the richest people from bolstering their rosters that way. However, there is no salary cap for coaches, front office, practice facilities, athletic training staff, every other aspect of your organization. You can spend as much damn money as you want to. So if you're not willing to pay up, whether it's the luxury tax, as we saw with the Lakers this past season with Alex Caruso, or in this case for Denver, you know, Tim Connelly, like, based on all reports coming out of Denver, everyone in the Nuggets organization is like, what are we doing, guys? This guy is one of the best presidents in sports. Like, he is the reason that we are as relevant as we are. We cannot let him walk out the door just because we're cheap. And yet it seems like that might be about to happen.
Yeah. Like, I understand why Denver fans are upset, or what miffed was your wording there.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. At the end of the day, if you're an NBA organization and you're serious about winning, if you're serious about presenting a very professional front here to everyone else, and you're owned by billionaires, not millionaires, billionaires, multi-billionaires, you should absolutely go out, load up your staff to the brink of the NBA actually sending you a memo going, don't you think you guys have enough people?
Like, you're right.
That's what you should do. The Suns have one of the smallest staffs in the NBA. Why? Like, why would you not?
We know why.
Right. But, I mean, again, like, the overall point here is, like, why would you cap yourself? Like, why would you limit yourself? Because the less people you have in an organization, the less knowledge there is to go around. It's not like I'm saying you need to have like 15 assistant general managers or anything of that sort, but just hire the best available people that you can. And if you find someone who's extraordinary, if you find someone who you think is worth gambling on for the long term, create a position for that person. Like, it's not difficult. Just create a new job. Say, hey, we need a director of insert false title here, and then hire that person into that newly created slot, pay that person whatever they're worth, and then enjoy the fruits later on. Like you said, when you don't have a salary cap on coaching staffs or training staffs, medical staff, whatever, spend like there's no tomorrow.
Right.
Otherwise, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, we always say team fans should want their teams to pay the tax, be willing to pay the tax. There are, you know, certain circumstances where, like, if you can, you know, if you're close enough to the apron that you can maybe get to the non-tax MLE instead of the tax MLE, all right, cool. Like, hope you can squeeze that in and, you know, stay under the apron, whatever. Like, that's
right.
That is the one exception, just because that's going to allow you to round your roster out more. But if,
correct,
you know, if you're the Bucks right now, like, are you not pissed that your ownership did not re-sign PJ Tucker? Like, would PJ Tucker have not potentially made a difference in this playoff run? If nothing else, made Miami weaker. And, you know, for what, like, right now, the Bucks, we talked about them a couple episodes ago. They already have $142 million salary. The tax line is going to be $149. If Bobby Portis and Pat Connaughton opt out, are they going to be willing to re-sign both of those guys? Like, you should put your ownership group, you know, put them on blast if they decide to make cost-cutting moves in any facet of the organization. Like, what a team owner does nothing, right? Like, you're just a billionaire, and we should not know your name. We should not think of you in any right. capacity other than, okay, this is the guy that writes the checks. But if you're not writing the checks, that's your only job.
Yeah.
Like, you hire people to do the rest of it, or you should, and you should stay hands off, because those people are going to know how to run a basketball team better than you. Right. They are lifers in that position. Like, okay, Steve Ballmer hires well-respected people, gets out of the way, shows up and dances at games. Great. And writes a ton of checks and, you know, authorizes them to add more salary ahead of time, add more to their luxury tax bill in a year that they're not competitive, just to give them advantage in future years. Like, that's the type of people that you're going up against. And if you're Denver with the two-time reigning MVP, you've got two other guys on max deals, all of whom he would, you know, Tim Connelly was responsible or helped bring into your organization. You are in the smack dab in the middle of your title window right now.
Yeah.
You're going to let this guy walk out the door a year before Jokic could become a free agent. I know he said he's going to sign the Supermax, and he probably will, but man, like, this is just not the time to be even remotely casting doubt on the future of your franchise.
Yep. Because imagine, even if you hire from within, you know, when you get to a higher level of job, you just don't know. Like, I brought up Calvin Booth. All I've heard about Calvin is great. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, what if it goes wrong? But what if it goes wrong? it's like you can't not think about it. Like, maybe that dynamic just isn't the same, and Jokic is like, you know what? This isn't what I'm looking for. Maybe I'm open to doing something else. Like, if you're Denver right now, you are looking at that Connelly situation. You're saying, you know what? Go take a meeting with Minnesota. Of course, you're allowed to do that. That's fine. Just give us a chance after you've taken that meeting and give us a chance to match.
Yeah. Yeah. Just treat him like a restricted free agent, basically.
Yeah. But without, like, just let us know what's going on.
Yeah.
And whatever you sign for, or not sign for, whatever you're offered, just know we will come back with something that's even better or something like that. You need to be proactive.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's not like ownership there is lacking for funds. Let's be honest.
Right. Right. Well, fingers crossed for our Denver Mutuals out there that things work out for you, or for the Timberwolves. Like, if you are, you know, any Timberwolves fans out there, I hope it works out for you, because Tim Connelly is an incredible team president. Has done an amazing job in Denver.
So what are you hoping for? You're hoping for it too. You're playing both sides here.
Yeah, I hope they clone him. And
okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
All right. No, honestly, I hope whichever team loses out on him has to hire a Colangelo.
Oh, wow. That went dark quick.
It's been too long since a Colangelo was in the league. We really need them back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, sure, Bri.
I think that is a good place for us to wrap up. So thank you all, as always, for listening in today. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, man. Don't die.